Hello, and welcome to Malice of Forethought UK, a true crime podcast which will bring you some of the famous, infamous, and lesser known true crime stories from here in the UK and across the globe. I'm your host, Kel, and all facts and information have been researched by me and are in the public domain. As with all true crime podcasts, there may be some descriptions of crimes that are distressing or disturbing. So listener discretion is advised at all times. Sit back, listen, and feel free to join our forum, a link of which is in the episode description, to discuss this and other true crime stories. Thank you. Hello, and welcome to Malice of Forethought UK. I'm about to start a multi-episode arc based on a case that happened in the 90s and absolutely shocked the nation. I'm not quite sure how many episodes it's going to run to yet. I'm new to podcasting, so this is quite difficult for me, but I have done a lot of research, so I'm going to take it stage by stage and see where we get to. The issue with this one is it's a story that has so many arms. It's almost like an octopus. I'm going to start with the original case and see where we go from there. So please be patient. Thank you. In episode one, I discussed the case of Kirsty Carver, a young woman at the start of her life who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and met the wrong man. That followed on to episode two, another young woman at the start of her life, even younger than Kirsty. Nicola was only 17. Again, a night out with friends, and met the wrong man at the wrong time down a dark alley, and he took her life. In relation to this story, I'm following the same theme: people being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But this time, we're not talking about a young woman. We're talking about a mother with two children, walking home from school in broad daylight, who met someone down a dark country road in the daytime and unfortunately met a grisly end. In 1998, at the trial, her husband, Dr. Sean Russell, gave testimony and said the words, "She had kissed me goodbye," which is unusual for us because we were normally in a rush. Every day people do normal things and some people don't come home. I'm going back to 1996, the same year that Nicola Dixon was murdered, but this time we're in the summertime. And it was probably like any ordinary day or any other ordinary morning in the Russell family home. But just over 2 years later, Dr. Sean Russell, an academic who woke up that morning as a married father of two, would have to recount the day from the witness box that he became a widower and a father of one. The family lived at Granary Cottage, which was near Chillenden in Kent. They had only moved there a few months earlier as Sean had got a full-time job and the family had decided to relocate rather than Sean commuting and coming home for the weekend because it would give them less family time. Chillenden itself is a village in East Kent in the southeast of England, which is between Canterbury and Deal and is a few miles southeast of Canterbury itself. The area is quite rural and known as the Garden of England due to its natural beauty and miles of countryside. His wife, Dr. Lynn Russell, was also an academic, and at the time she was not working and was busying herself during the day while Sean was at work, doing the housework, decorating the cottage and gardening. And in the meantime, in that busy day, she would find herself taking their daughters back and forward to school and to various after-school activities, like any normal family up and down the country. Sean and Lynn had two daughters. Josie, the eldest, was aged 9, and Megan was aged 6, and that particular day was going to be very busy for Lynn. She was picking the girls up from school late as they were going to a swimming gala. Then she was going to walk them home, get them ready, and then take them to Brownies. Her friend Liz had offered to pick them up from the house at 5 o'clock and drive them to the Brownies induction. Sean was giving the lift to the girls to school. So Lynn walked him and the girls to the car. There was a quick kiss goodbye and he drove off, not knowing that would be the last time he would see his wife alive. The last image he holds close to his heart is that of his beloved wife walking back through her garden and into the home with their pet dogs trotting happily beside her. Sean's first stop of the morning was Goodnestone to drop his girls off outside school. Both were wearing typical summer primary school uniforms of blue gingham dresses, and they ran off to join their classmates. Again, he didn't know this would be the last time he would see one of his daughters alive, Megan, and the next time he would hold Josie, she would be so severely injured she could not speak. He continued onwards to work, and a normal day was played out as in homes up and down the country, but for that particular gentleman, his life would change forever, and he would never truly know normal in the same way again. During the day, Sean had run some errands in Canterbury, including a trip to the library to return some books the girls had borrowed. He was caught on CCTV going about his normal day, and this CCTV footage was later used to corroborate his alibi. At approximately 7 p.m, he packed up at work and decided to head home. Even though Lynn had told him she may be late home, when he arrived at 7:30 p.m, he found the house locked up and in darkness, and it came as a little bit as a surprise to him. The only one there to greet him was their old retriever dog, Jackie. He had expected them back by then, but assuming plans had changed, he began to prepare supper as promised that morning. As time passed, thoughts passed through his mind. Had Lynn decided to go to Liz's for a while? Surely she would have called him to confirm. So he checked the answering machine, but there were no messages. More time passed and still no word. He began to think of possible reasons for their lateness. He feared the dog had gone missing and the family were searching for it, but as night began to fall, he became increasingly worried. Obviously, we are going back to 1996. Mobile phones were not prevalent. Most people didn't have them at the time, and even if you had one, the coverage wasn't always great. So it wouldn't have been unusual for him not to have been able to get in contact with her if she was late, and perhaps she would have had to have found a telephone box to ring him on the landline. An hour had passed by, it was now 8:30. And at this point, Sean was really starting to get worried. Then the phone rang and he dashed to answer it. It was Lynn's friend Liz on the phone. At this point, he really began to panic, particularly when Liz explained that, as had arranged, she had gone to the house at 5 p.m. to pick up Lynn and the girls to take them to Brownies, and there was no sign of her. However, she assumed Lynn had decided to find her own way to Brownies and she'd carried on regardless. But when she went to pick her daughter up at the end of Brownies, there was no sign of Lynn. So she was giving her a ring to see why she didn't go to Brownies and what had happened. Sean told Liz the only possible explanation he could think of for them not being there at 5 o'clock and still being out at 8:30 at night is perhaps their dog Lucy had got lost. And if that had happened, he knew his wife would scour the countryside looking for her lost dog. Liz sounded quite worried, but promised to call Sean later and suggested he ring around and see if anybody knew anything, and she would keep the phone line free for him. However, thinking there was a possibility that they were out looking for Lucy, Sean thought he would retrace their steps. He jumped into his car and decided to drive along the road towards the school, heading in on the route towards Sandwich, trying to follow what he would believe their walk home would be. He hoped they would just appear out of nowhere, tired, hungry, but finally either finding their lost dog or explaining they were still looking for her. En route to the school, he had to go down a very narrow lane, which they would have walked down. It was virtually a dirt track. It was called Cherry Garden Lane, and it was in the countryside, off Station Road, on the very outskirts of the village of Chillenden, where they lived. He knew that this would have been a shortcut that they would have walked in the countryside on their way home. In summer, the track was quite overgrown, and by this point, it was night, about 9 o'clock, so it was too dark to see. And he put his headlights on and drove as slowly as he possibly could down the track, which was very bumpy and uneven. He saw nothing. He came out the other end and he circled back to home, still no sign of his wife and children. Unbeknown to him, his family were lying just a few feet from where he had driven, just off the side of Cherry Garden Lane track. As tragic as it was that he had missed them by feet, it is perhaps lucky he was not the one to find them. At this point, they had been missing for several hours. It was dark and the weather was not as warm, so he decided to report his family missing to the police. He had frantically rang around everyone he could think of, and then he got through to the local police station. He was transferred through to an operations centre that told him there had been no reported accidents in the area that evening. He rang the hospitals. He moved further and further afield, but no one had anyone admitted by the name of Russell or fitting the description of his family. Just after 10 p.m, Liz rang back for an update. At this point, she could hear the fear in Sean's voice. So she shouted to her husband, John, "Get the car out. We're coming straight round to Sean's." At this point, the genuine concern in Liz's voice and his own panic made him realise that something must be seriously wrong. And he made a second call to the police. The police seemed to take this second call seriously and said they would send an officer straight round to Granary Cottage. Unbeknown to Sean, his first call to the local police station had actually been taken a little more seriously than he'd realised, and the police had already prepared a dog unit and a search team. So Liz and John arrived at the house to console the terrified Sean, and shortly afterwards, about 11 p.m, two police officers arrived at the house. Those officers remained with him, and other officers started to put the search underway. The two officers that remained with him were interviewing him and asking him lots of questions. They wanted descriptions of Lynn and the girls, where their last movements might have been. Had the couple had an argument? Could Sean think of any reason why she would take the kids away without his knowledge? Was anything missing from the house? Had she packed a bag? Where were her passports? Who had he called? Is there anywhere that they could go? Were they visiting family? At this point, he was so terrified, he couldn't even comprehend why the police were asking him these sorts of questions. They continued to probe him, and Liz, at this point, and John realised that they were suggesting that Lynn had taken the girls away of her own accord, and that perhaps it was to escape from Sean, and that she had done it in secret. It was so late in the evening now. It was getting close to midnight. It was way past the girls' bedtime. He did not feel at this point that he was wasting police time anymore. He kept answering the questions. Originally, he thought he'd been overcautious, but at this point, he was absolutely distraught. Hoping against hope, he was worrying unduly, and there was a simple explanation for their disappearance. Years later, in October 19th, 2000, a book was published, written by Dr. Sean Russell and published by BBC Books. And he recalled the events of that evening in clear and concise detail, saying, "By now, I was too worried to be overly concerned at the suggestion. I started giving them more thorough descriptions and telling them what I had already done that evening to find Lynn and the girls. It was late enough now that I felt no embarrassment at calling out the police, but I was still clinging to the notion that a benign explanation could be found for Lynn and the girls' disappearance. The worst thing that I now considered was that one of them might have been involved in an accident. I tried to avert painful thoughts of one or other of the girls being hit by a car as they walked down narrow lanes near to home. It never entered my mind that something more sinister might have befallen them." The questioning continued, and frustration started to impinge on the feeling of fear for my family's safety that was now consuming me. How long would this go on before the police started to do something? The question was answered almost immediately, as at about 11:30, a bus full of police officers skidded into the gravel driveway next to Granary Cottage, accompanied by a white van with a dog search team. At midnight, they set off in the direction of Cherry Garden Lane. Now I was starting to go numb with worry. My brain was not allowing me to think beyond hospitalization for one of the girls as this worst possible scenario. I was hanging on in a kind of limbo, with the vague hope that someone would arrive with Lynn and the girls smiling and embarrassed in the back of their car and some sort of rational explanation for it all. I accepted another cup of tea from Liz and John, and we spoke very little as we paced up and down outside in the driveway in the darkness. Lights glowed in police cars parked at the end of the drive, and radios crackled. Suddenly, at about 1 a.m., another police car pulled into the parking area near to the houses. From the darkness emerged the two officers who had questioned me earlier. One spoke quietly to Liz and John, while the other asked me in a subdued voice to accompany him back into the house. At about 15:15, officers found Megan's swimming costume in Cherry Garden Lane, and 15 minutes later, they came across the bodies of Lynn, Megan, and Josie, with Lucy, the family dog. Sean knew terrible news was coming, and the officers explained there was some sort of accident, and there seemed to be suspicious circumstances. And this was the worst news he had ever had to give anyone, as all members of Sean's family were dead. Sean was then told he would need to go to Deal, to the police station, to answer more questions. Liz urged him to stay with them at the house. He needed to rest. He was in shock, and she wanted to keep him safe from all the police probing questions. She had a suspicion as to what was being suggested by the police, given their tact. But perhaps due to shock, he decided to go to the police station. On the journey in the back of the police car, his emotions got the better of him, and he was delirious with grief. He shouted, screamed, cried, and talked about ending it all. Meanwhile, at the scene, police, forensics, and doctors all sprung into action in the dark night. The scene was horrific. Now, at this point, I'm going to put a caveat in because I'm going to explain the nature of what happened. So, if you do not want to listen to the brutality of the family's injuries, just skip forward a couple of minutes. Lynn had blunt trauma injuries, and it was found she had been hit on the head at least 15 times, which caused severe head trauma and had killed her. Josie's skull was smashed and brain tissue was protruding from a wound behind her left ear. There were several lacerations to her skull and extensive tearing to the covering of her brain. Megan had been hit at least 7 times, suffering massive skull fractures, again with exposed brain tissue, and Lucy the dog had been slaughtered. It was only after some time had elapsed at the scene that Josie was still found to have a pulse. Dr. Michael Parks, the police doctor who had been called to examine the bodies, carried her, cradled in his arms, to a police car, and she was rushed first to Kent and Canterbury Hospital in Canterbury, and then, by ambulance, to the intensive care unit at King's College Hospital in London. At the trial, it was said that in spite of being seriously injured, Josie made a recovery that no one would have predicted. At 6 a.m. the following morning, he was still at the police station in Deal. Exhausted with grief, he'd been up all night, and then the police told him there'd been a major development. And despite being told that earlier that night that all of his family had died, one of the girls had survived, but the police did not know which one it was. Sean heartbrokenly asked, did the girl have freckles or not? Sean was then driven to London to King's College Hospital so he could identify which of his two girls had survived the attack. Looking at his little girl covered in tubes and a mask in the intensive care unit, he could still spot the tiny dusting of freckles across her nose, and he knew that Josie was alive, and suddenly he found he had a reason to live. Whilst Josie's recovery was slowly taking place, Kent Police continued to work on other leads and inquiries and any other eyewitness testimony in and around the area that could help them create a timeline of events. At around 4:45, which was estimated as within half an hour after the attack, a man was seen by a driver near the Chillenden windmill, which was northeast of the crime scene. He was hanging around at the edge of a winding lane and holding a claw hammer. The witness did not see anyone nearby or a vehicle that he could have used to get there. But 15 minutes later, a walker had spotted a man parked up in a beige car alongside a hedge, and he was acting suspiciously. So at 5:30, the same walker took his dog out for a walk and went to where the man had been parked. There he'd found a string bag containing strips of bloody toweling. He called the police, told them what he had seen, and they went and retrieved the string bag and its contents. They also found a boot lace on Cherry Garden Lane which was covered in blood. Josie would later describe being tied up with it, and the pathologist thought Megan could have been strangled with a boot lace. A lady who had drove past Station Road, which leads into Cherry Garden Lane, shortly after the attack, described a beige car speeding out of Station Road right in front of her and forced her to brake suddenly. The driver kept looking in his rearview mirror at her. His behaviour was so odd that she actually remembered it quite clearly, and she was confident enough in that because of what she'd noticed, she could compile an e-fit with Kent Police. London Weekend Television had a programme called Crime Monthly, and this was the first television company to reconstruct the crime, and it was shown shortly after the attacks while Josie was still in hospital, unable to communicate. Meanwhile, due to all of the activity with the police overnight, Sean had not even had time to tell his extended family what had happened. It was while he was at the hospital, sitting in the canteen, drinking a cup of coffee and trying to calm down, talking to one of the police officers, that he saw on the television a story on the news, and he realised it was the story of his family. Realising it was then public knowledge, he asked the officer about borrowing a telephone to call Lynn's parents to break the tragic news to them. But it was too late. Tragically, Lynn's parents had discovered the news via the media before Sean had time to break their loss to them in person. The police continued their investigation, but suddenly their focus shifted as they had a potential key eyewitness who could not only shed light on the events of the previous evening, but potentially could be a threat to the killer and may be in danger. Josie was alive. Detective Chief Inspector Dave Stevens of Kent Police spoke on the 11th of July 1996. He said, "This is the most horrific and terrible murder I have had the misfortune to come across in my 23 years as a police officer. Whoever has done this must have a propensity to do it again. The nature of this offence makes it almost unique." No one would pretend Josie would be able to give a lucid and coherent account of the attack, even if she continued to survive her injuries. But two family liaison officers with the police decided to keep a vigil by her bedside. This was in two parts. The first, to keep her safe from any retributive attack, and in part to ensure that should she survive, any detail she could recall, however minor, could be recorded immediately as evidence. Over the coming weeks, the doctors began to become confident that Josie was recovering, and although they could not give a prognosis of any long-term cognitive or physical issues she would, they believed, survive. So the police remained at her bedside 24/7, hoping, due to improvements, she could tell them any important or vital information at the right time when she was ready. The reconstruction showed actors playing the family walking along Cherry Garden Lane close to the local landmark of the Chillenden Windmill, which is a white windmill and is overlooking the lane. This was to remind watchers of the idyllic countryside where the Russell family had moved to, with the belief this would be the perfect place to raise their children. Following this reconstruction, another eyewitness came forward to say they had seen a beige saloon car on the lane, and a similar car had also been spotted by someone else 20 minutes later, where another witness had seen a man in a red top acting suspiciously. It turned out that this was close to where the girl's school bag had been found dumped. Following all these eyewitnesses, an EFIT was released, as they all described a stocky, fair-haired man. Forensics in the meantime were slowly progressing, and hairs were found on the children's shoes that didn't match the family, and a single fingerprint was found in blood on a lunchbox. What followed was a manhunt based on the images of the man believed to have been driving the beige car, the man with the red top. While the nation's attention was captured by the horrific events, Josie was still in hospital, slowly recovering in a way that seemed nothing less than a miracle. She needed extensive surgery on her head injuries, and still to this day, she struggles sometimes with speaking and concentration. But after 6 long weeks, she was released from hospital, and the police continued to interview and video her at home to build up a picture of the attack. They used scrapbooks and built little models as an aid to Josie, who was still having language and speech difficulties. Josie reconstructed the events surrounding the murders using the models. Models were made of the murder scene, and she giggled as the police showed her little models of herself, her mum and her sister and their pet dog Lucy. And slowly the events were coaxed out of her. As the family were walking home from school in the neighbouring village of Goodnestone, they were chatting between themselves about the events of the day and the swimming gala, and a car had passed by them on the track road of Cherry Garden Lane. Suddenly, a hush fell on their conversation as their mum noticed that the car had pulled across the road at an angle, blocking them, and the man was sat in his car and the car wasn't moving. As they got a little bit closer, the man got out of the car. They had never seen him before, and there was something about his menacing manner that immediately raised alarm bells for Mum. He then went round and opened the rear door of the car, and from the parcel shelf at the back, he took out a hammer. He walked up to the family and demanded money from Lynn. But she'd just picked up the girls from school. She was out with the dog. She hadn't even taken her handbag with her. She had no money, no cash, no bank cards. But she did say to him she would go home and get some for him. In May 1997, using models, dolls, basic words, sign language, Josie managed to communicate enough to record a testimony. This was very painstaking for the police, but Josie managed to say, "The man said, 'Give me your money.' My mum said, 'I've got no money. Shall I go back in my house and get some?' The man said, 'No.' Josie said her mother told Josie, 'Run home, get help.'" Due to the head injury she suffered, communication and speech was difficult for Josie, but she managed to explain that she had barely made it around the corner before the man caught up to her and grabbed her and hit her from behind with the hammer, but inflicted only a slight injury. She said, "No, no, then tie me up, and me ran in here," pointing around the corner, "and hammer, bang, then, okay, okay, okay." Josie described how her mother told her to try to escape and added, "Mum said, 'No, no, come on and run.'" Once this happened, Josie was dragged back to her mother and sister. "Then he tied me up and me ran in here and hammer, bang, bang. Then okay, okay, okay." Josie said the stranger bound her with her pair of her tights, but loosened them after she complained. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Not tight, so take her off." Tied and blindfolded, he led the family to the trees in a small copse just off the lane, claiming he was going to leave them there before driving off. Josie was tied to a tree while her mother was bound with strips torn from their swimming towels. But in an act of unspeakable violence, he started savagely attacking Lynn Russell with a hammer. Josie could hear her mother being attacked and Lynn crying out for him to stop before she was attacked herself. She passed out, and it was more than 8 hours before she was found clinging to life. Josie described her attacker as a man in his 20s with blonde spiky hair, matching the previously released effit of the attacker from the other eyewitnesses. So now the police had the where, they had a description of the who, but they still couldn't understand the why. It was difficult to find leads when the crime had so little motive. Lynn was wearing jewellery, none was taken. The family were all beaten incredibly savagely, and even the family dog was killed. There was no sexual element, no sexual assaults to any of the victims. The victims seemed to have been chosen completely at random. The killer seemed to have had no real interest in concealing his identity. He'd attacked in the daylight. There was lots of people around who saw him and his car, so they could give a description. And the level of violence seemed incredibly excessive. Although there was no robbery, he had made a search of the girls' school bags before the attack, and he had used items from the bags, such as the swimming costumes and towels, to bind the victims. So although he'd had a hammer with him, he never really had anything with him to tie them up or keep them, so it would seem that the hammer was merely there as a threat. So why then, after he realised they had no money, did he not just run away? Why did he stay behind? And why so savagely kill them? The level of violence was incredibly forceful. Lynn had about 15 injuries, Megan about 7, and Josie about 16, despite Josie surviving. Following the attack, the killer had come out of the wooded area, got back in his car and drove off. He had just left them, not caring if they were dead or alive, just off that dirt track. So a further reconstruction was developed using Josie's memories. And at this point, a psychiatrist called the police about one of his patients he was worried about, a man called Michael Stone, who looked very much like the Ifrit, and the psychiatrist said Stone was in the mood for killing. Following the tragedy, Sean and Josie left Granary Cottage and returned to North Wales, where they had lived before moving to Kent. Josie's an adult now, and she's become a successful textiles artist. And Dr. Russell himself is a leading horticultural expert at the University of Bangor in Wales. Josie is now building a successful art career and makes stunning landscapes from recycled cloth, and I will put a link to her website in the episode description if you want to go and look at some of the beautiful artwork that Josie sells. But if you don't want to look in the episode description, just go to www.josierussell.com. That's the end of episode one. I will continue this story arc. But in the meantime, be nice to each other, and I hope you enjoyed listening. Thank you. Thank you.